Today's Teisho will be on Case 51 in the Book of Serenity. Case 51 is entitled Phaon's Boat or Land. Introduction. In mundane truth, how many people have been enlightened? In Buddhist truth, how many people have been deluded? If they suddenly become one, can you then define delusion or enlightenment? Case. Phaon asked Elder Zhao, "Did you come by boat or by land?" Zhao said, "By boat." Phaon said, "Where is the boat?" Zhao said, "The boat is on the river." After Zhao had withdrawn, Phaon turned and asked a monk standing nearby, "You tell me, did that monk just now have eyes or not?" Verse, water doesn't wash, gold isn't changed for gold. Find a horse without knowing its color. Enjoy the lute without the strings. Tying knots, drawing trigrams, when there are such things, completely lost is the true, pure mind of the original person. I would like to thank all of you for coming here today. This is our usual Saturday sit. We all come here and we think we know why. We might say we're coming here because we're in pursuit of enlightenment. Maybe that's an answer we would give. Maybe in our minds we have an idea that enlightenment might involve something like a kind of not exactly all-knowing quality, but the ability to make judgments that are accurate, truthful, reliable, and so on. When I was younger, I ran into a Japanese monk. His name was Genki Takabayashi. And at that time in my life, things seemed very, very confused. You know, very, very uncertain. I had sort of drifted through college. I had taken major in English literature and anthropology, and I wasn't really sure what I was doing. And then I got out of college, and I didn't exactly know what I wanted to do with my life. I really didn't think I wanted to be an English professor, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to be an anthropologist. So I took a bunch of jobs that were available to me. You know, just jobs that that presented themselves. So one of my first jobs was running a restaurant. And that was an amazing experience because I had not really understood the importance of details. I had, in college, I had done a lot of construction work. And construction, the kind of construction work I did, it really just required me to be strong and hardworking. So I would show up at 7 o'clock in the morning at the site, and the boss would give us shovels and say, "Dig a trench here." And we'd spend the whole day digging a trench, and at the end of the day, you could drive home. It was dead simple. And I liked it. I really liked that kind of work. I could listen to the birds. I was outside. know, where you could take a break whenever you wanted to. I liked it. I enjoyed physical. I liked the feeling of being tired at the end of the day, physically tired. So there was a kind of purity and simplicity in the life of like a laborer that I enjoyed quite a bit. But then when I was managing this restaurant, it wasn't like that at all. You know, I had to get there very, very early in the morning. And there were always lots of details that had to be attended to. You had to order, make sure that you had ordered enough of everything you needed for each meal. And there were lots of little details. You know, you might have to check the coffee to make sure that the coffee urn was getting the coffee hot enough. You had to make sure that, the toaster was set to the right setting. The toast couldn't be too light. It couldn't be too dark. If a cook didn't show up, I had to cook. If the dishwasher didn't show up, I had to do the dishes in the big machine. And so from very early in the morning until very late at night, I was constantly struggling with all these details, and I would get quite overwhelmed by it, really. I was supposed to be responsible for this whole restaurant. I was supposed to do the books. I was supposed to do the books at the end of the day. If a customer wasn't happy, I had to go out and meet the customer and try to talk the customer into not being angry, you know, offer the customer an extra something, you know, and sometimes I would get exasperated. You know, people would eat their whole meal and then they'd complain. And, I was so tempted to say, well, you ate the meal, you know. But I always had to be very polite, very pleasant. You know, the customer was always right. Even if I thought the customer was a jerk, I worked hard to, project a good image. You know, I wanted people to say this was a good place to eat. So then after that, I moved furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company. Before I went back to graduate school, I had other jobs, you know. And I got to graduate school not quite knowing what I really wanted to do. I sort of went to graduate school because I didn't know what else to do with my life. And it seemed as though every time I was, it seemed again and again I would find myself in these places, at these intersections, where I was faced with these decisions and I didn't know how to decide, you know. I didn't know what to do. And I always felt very uncertain, you know, very pulled in two directions, very conflicted is the word I'm looking for. Very conflicted in the decisions I had to make. And I have to say I worried a great deal, you know. I enjoyed, after I got out of college, I went to backpacking. I worked at, in some jobs of the kind I described, and those jobs gave me a lot of free time to do backpacking, which I loved. And I spent like a glorious about 4 or 5 months with my friend Larry Sullivan backpacking in the Rocky Mountains. And that was just truly wonderful. But, you know, I got out of college, I think, in 1975. And the first year I was working in a restaurant. And then the second year I was working for the Mayflower Moving Company. And the third year I was doing, I can't remember what else I was doing. But the point is that, 3 years went by, and I didn't know what I was doing, who I was, you know. And I began to worry a lot, you know, like I can't go on living my life this way. This is very aimless. I don't have any goals. I should have goals. What should my goals be? And then when I got to graduate school, I was very tense because, I thought, well, this is my one shot at having a life that makes some sense, you know, that's coherent and that is, you know, has some value or meaning. And I ought to try to do well in graduate school. But then I would be sort of petrified by anxiety because so many people in graduate school really wanted to be there. I wasn't sure I really wanted to be there, and I wasn't sure I could succeed. You know, people were very, very smart, and they spoke multiple languages, and they were very, you know, seemed to me very brilliant, very well-read. And so anyway, I met this priest, Genki Roshi was his name, Takabayashi Genki Roshi. And I was just, the other day, I was just meditating in my home. And I remembered, after many, many years, how it felt to go there to Genki Roshi's place where we used to sit in the morning. And there was a kind of stillness and stability and silence. I remembered it after all these years. There was a feel or a mood when I would go to sit with him in the morning. It was so reassuring, and it was so tranquil, and it was so calming, and it was like a kind of unshakable stillness or unshakable silence. So I would come in and I would sit down on the cushion in the morning, and I would think, I shouldn't be here. I should be doing my graduate studies. I should be getting ready for class. Why am I here? This is a big mistake. You know, I'm wasting my life. Who am I? You know, and so on. And then I would, you know, watch my breath, and I remember this. There would just be this wonderful stillness or solidity in the room. And by the end of the morning, you know, we started it. Maybe it was, I think we might have started at 5 o'clock. I think that's when we started sitting, 5 o'clock. And then by 6:30, it was like I was very calm, very still and stable. And then we'd have breakfast, and then we would all go off to our jobs, you know, or off to school. I remember that after all these years. You know, and then I went to graduate school. I got my PhD. I went out on the job market. You know, I have to say that at every step in my life, it seems, I have been worried. You know, and it seems like I'm always at a crossroads where I have to choose. And I'm terribly worried about making the wrong choice. You know, I don't know if this ever happens to you. I think it probably has. Where, you know, it just seems like at every stage, I've been at this crossroads, and I've had to choose, and I've been really worried that I was going to make the wrong choice. This just seems so human, right? I've worried a lot in my life. I think that by nature I'm kind of a worrier. So I can worry about anything, you know. And I think I have just about worried about anything and everything. So Zazen has really helped me a lot. Hugely, you know. Really, I would say. My sister-in-law has been going through a really difficult time. She got a degree in, I guess, anthropology at the University of New Mexico. She got a BA. And then she married a young man who was also an anthropology major at UNM. And then they got jobs in town, and they had a child, and then they had another child, and they were living in an apartment, and they wanted a house so badly. My sister-in-law's name is Chris. And Chris used to actually, you know, experience suffering, because she didn't own a house, and she would really be unhappy. You know, she would think, if I only owned a house, I would be so happy. Right? She had it. You know, something might be going on in her life, and she would think, oh, you know, if only I had a house right now, I'd be happier. She would have other sorts of disappointments, but she would reassure herself that someday she was going to have a house, and then they would all be a family. You know, then we'll finally be a real family. She and her husband saved their money, and they don't make a lot of money, so it was really difficult for them, and they bought a house. They worried about it, just, you know, the way I would, you know. They worried about which house to buy, and they looked all over Albuquerque. And they finally found this house that was, they looked at this house and this house and this house, and they didn't want to blow it, you know, they didn't want to blow it, because this was their one shot at a house. Some houses were too expensive, some houses were too run down. So they went through this process, and then they had to negotiate the price, and they didn't quite have enough money, so they worried about that, probably, I imagine, if they're like me, they worried about everything. You know, they worried about which house to get. They worried about the financing. And so on and so on. And they finally got this house. And the house was like, as we say, like a mixed blessing, right? Because, first of all, they finally had a home. You know, finally owned a house. But then they realized, you know, the house was kind of old and there was a lot of maintenance. So they worried all the time about maintenance. I was just talking to her, and her furnace has gone out, and she has to replace her furnace, which is $6,000. And that's a lot of money for anybody, right? And she doesn't quite have it. So right now she has all these space heaters in her living room, right? And they're sleeping in a few rooms with the heaters on. And it's the middle of winter in Albuquerque. And she said to me, I wish I'd never bought this house. You know, and I mean that's so human, isn't it? So I wish she said, "I wish I'd never bought this damn house." You know? I have to say, my wife and I went through the same thing. You know, we had never owned a house. I was a graduate student. First of all, I lived in apartments most of my life. You know, she grew up in a house. Her father had was an engineer and a designer. He designed their house. It's a beautiful house. So anyway, she really wanted to have a house. My wife, Barbara, really wanted to have a house. And I had never had one. So I thought, if we have a house, something will be different. So, when the market crashed, I think it was in 93 or something like that, suddenly houses that we couldn't afford were affordable, and we got this house, and we didn't pay a lot of money for it, which was a lucky break, you know. But as soon as we got the house, it became more expensive than we thought. Maintenance, and things would go wrong. You know, the water heater, the first time we moved in, the water heater blew up right within like a couple of weeks, and we had to replace that. We were just barely making the mortgage, you know. And then there's this, when we were getting the house, I worried. You know, we had to take a mortgage. I'd never had a debt like that. I wake up at night and think, oh my God, am I really going to do this? You know, hundreds of thousands, that's a lot of money. I'm going to be... So I'd worry about that. You know. And then when we bought the house, it turns out that the roof was not good. So, I would go up to the attic, and I could see there, we had to have little pots, catching the water, So you could go up into the attic, and you could look, and there were like all these little pots catching water. And when it really would rain, I'd go up there, and you could hear the rain, bing, 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 bing. And I think, oh my God, the house is going to be destroyed, oh. But then, you'd get the guy out, and he'd look at the roof, and he'd say, well, that's going to be a big job. It's going to be, I don't know what, $14,000 or something like that, which I didn't have, So we just kept adding pots. And I would wake up at night and think, oh my God, what if we run out of pots? And the time has, you know, came when I said, I wish I hadn't bought this damn house, you know. Life looks like something we can plan out, and we have goals which are necessary and important, you know. But and generally we worry at every step of the way, right? We worry at every step, and this is like a very difficult way to live, right? You know, very difficult. You could say, well, why do we worry? You know, because I believe too, on some level, that I can control my life. You know, I just believe it. And as so much of our culture encourages us to believe this, right? So, you know, there are actually people who are professional life planners, you know, or financial planners. You can go to a financial planner and they'll tell you, you know, what to do. Here's how to, you know, and I myself have gone to a financial planner, you know, and the financial planner said, put some money here, put some money here, put some money here, do this, do this. You know, basically, we believe in that life can be planned, and that if we were just smart enough, and we were just maybe enlightened enough, we'd know how to act decisively, you know. So when I was disorganized as a young man, and I didn't know which way to turn, up or down, left or right, and so on, I would go and sit with Genki Roshi, and he seemed so together. Now, I don't know if they use that word anymore, but in the 60s, most people weren't together. You know, they were like a wreck, you know. But if somebody seemed to have his act together, say, oh, he really has his act together, you know. Genki Roshi really seemed to have his act together, you know. He was very, very disciplined. He would come into a room, he would just sit down. He wouldn't dither. You know, he'd come in, he'd sit down. You know, he'd say, when you eat, eat. You know, do this, do this. You know, and it was great. You know, this is wonderful. So I thought, you know, if I just do enough Zen practice, you know, I'll have like a super intelligence or something, and I'll be able to see what needs to be done. Right? I'll be freed from this indecisiveness or this feeling of being at a crossroads all the time, right? My brother was a businessman, and he was actually pretty good at it, you know. My brother got a degree in biology from William & Mary, and he didn't want to go to graduate school, so he started working for an import company, for a very nice man whose name was Joseph Shia. Joseph Shia was, I think he was either a Syrian or a Lebanese man, who was in the, he would import Middle Eastern rugs. That was his job. And he hired my brother to work for him. And then my brother actually bought the company. Nobody would buy rugs from the Spellmeyer Asian carpets, Oriental carpets. But so he kept the name Shia. He was very successful. And my brother was kind of cute. Because he was in business, and he was pretty successful. But he constantly felt like he didn't know what he was doing. And he would say to me, if only I had gotten an MBA, I'd know what to do. You know, and because there'd be one thing after another. You know, this would happen, this would happen. You know, he rented a place, he rented his store for a while, and the guy would see that my brother was doing well, and he'd raise the rent every time the contract ran out. You know, so my brother would say, oh, if only I had an MBA, I would know how to handle this. You know, he was handling it, but he felt that if only I had, you know, I could have a kind of knowledge that would prevent me from being in these situations where I don't know where to turn. You know, and we think, I thought Genki Roshi was the kind of person who could see. He'd look, size it up, do this. And he seemed so decisive, right, that I thought, well, he must see. I don't see it, but he sees it. You know, he knows what to do. And of course, people think that way about old people, too. You know, in the old days, people used to actually revere old people. They thought old people knew what they were doing. You know, I'm getting older, and I find that harder and harder to believe, you know. I think older people aren't any really more together than anybody else, you know. So anyway, we have a deep desire, right, to believe that we can predict, you know, we can know what to do. We can draw a straight line from point A to point B, and we can go to point B. You know, we're encouraged to think that way, you know, from the minute we are out of our cradles, you know. When you get to college, you're supposed to have a plan, an objective. And I'm amazed at how many of my students do. You know, I'll say, I'm teaching a new course. I went around the room. Everybody, you know, told me what they wanted to do. There were only two people who were sort of like me in college. They said, I don't know what I want to do. You know, and everybody looked at them like, whoa, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, most of these people say, you know, I want to be a doctor. And I said, what kind of medicine? And, you know, and they would tell me what kind of medicine. It was amazing. You know, so they all have life plans. You know, on the other hand, I was reading something in the newspaper the other day. It was an interview with George Soros. Some of you might know who George Soros is. He's this investor who actually is very idealistic. He has spent millions and millions of dollars he spends millions of dollars on really liberal, progressive causes that he believes in, and he's much hated by the political right. But he was being interviewed, and they said, "Well, what do you think is going to happen to the economy?" And he said, "I have no idea." He said, "To tell you the truth, I don't know where to put my money," and this is one of the richest men in the world. And he said, "I have no idea." He said, "I really don't know." He said, "I don't know." He said, "I really don't know where the world economy is going." He said, "Right now," he said, and this is, I swear, he said, "Right now, all I'm thinking about is survival." He said, "Okay." Now his idea of survival is different from mine, I think. You know. Nevertheless, you know, here's a guy who should know, right? He's famous for having bet against the pound. And there was a devaluation of the pound that left him one of the richest men in the world. You know, basically, he walked off with about 20% of Great Britain's wealth. Seriously. So he's a very shrewd investor, but he doesn't have a clue. You know, and basically, very few economists predicted the crash we had in 2008, and now most of them don't know what to do. I read an interview with another economist, a man named Nouriel Roubini. And he said, "I don't know what to do." He said, "I'm going to just keep it all in cash under my bed." He didn't really say under my bed, but he said, "I'm going to put it all in cash right now." He said, "That's, I think, the safest thing to do." You know, we think we can go from point A to point B. And we think, you know, basically, that if we just knew enough or we were just privy to something, the openness of things would not exist. But the openness of things is fundamentally the nature of the world, you know. And so, you know, one way to think about Zen is that it's about how to live with that predicament. How to live with that predicament. Because we are uncomfortable with that openness. You know, being the small mind creatures we are, we want to know, we want to plan, we want to predict, and there's, within reason, there's nothing wrong with that, you know. So, you know, I just bought a life, and my life insurance ran out, and I just bought a new life insurance policy. So if anything happens to me, my wife will be safe, you know, protected. So I mentioned during the session, the Buddha actually was in favor of life insurance policies. He was. He actually spoke about it. So he said, "I think you should look into life insurance," you know, in one of his talks, you know. So he did believe in being practical, you know, taking care of the details, you know, crossing your T's and dotting your I's. But on the other hand, life has this fundamental openness that is inescapable, you know, so that Even the smartest investors in the world don't know where to put their money for tomorrow. And so, you know, that seems to mean we're condemned to a life at standing at the crossroads worrying about the future. And so it's like, I have my life all planned out for me. Tonight, I'll lie in my bed and I'll worry. I'm not sure what I'll be worried about, but I'll be worried about something, right? So I can toss and turn. Oh, my God. You know, I can go up and... Fortunately, I have a new roof, right? So that problem has been solved. But now there's another problem. The bathroom is leaking. It's true. I'm not making this up. So when you come into my house, the plaster has fallen off the wall because there's a leak somewhere in the bathroom. I don't know where, right? And I had a plumber come, and he declined to take the job because he doesn't know where the leak is, right? And he charged me for an hour, you know, at $100 an hour or something, and then he left. So basically, this is my new worry. I can go home and worry about this until it's resolved. There'll be something else. Probably I'll have to interrupt that worry because there'll be something else, you know. So I'll put that worry on hold, and I can worry about my next problem. You know? This is one way to live, right? And we all tend in this direction. It's unrealistic to think that that in life, I mean, even the Dalai Lama has things that worry him, I'm sure. You know, even the Dalai Lama, you know, must get worried sometime. You know, for all kinds of reasons, obviously. You know, you worry about Tibet, you know, worry... You know. So it's probably unrealistic to think we can live a life without worry, but it's on the other hand, that's probably not the best way to live. You know, it's probably not the best way to live because the uncontrollability of life is, it's not like our knowledge is defective, and if only we had better knowledge, we'd know what the future holds. I don't think that's true. I think the world is really open-ended. I think it's a complex system. And, you know, the more we study complex systems, the more we realize that they're not linear, and you can't just scale up what you already know. You know, there's a high level of uncertainty in life. And it's inescapably part of complex systems that there's high levels of uncertainty, you know. Even no matter how meticulously you plan, there can be, you know, the black swan, the thing that happens that you couldn't possibly have foreseen, and it happens with some regularity. Now you can't, you know, live your life just assuming the world is totally irrational. So, you know, that would be a mistake. But on the other hand, you know, we're condemned to a life of fear and worry unless we can find some other resting place for our mind. And I think that Zazen is like that resting place, you know, the bigger perspective. You know, the small mind really is addicted to control. It's all about control and prediction, right? And so, you know, we need that part of our minds. That's the part of the mind that, you know, gets life insurance. And life insurance is a wonderful invention, really, you know. I mean, I actually go to bed feeling better knowing that if I get killed, you know, my wife won't be out on the street. You know, she can make the house payments and so on. That's a wonderful feeling, knowing somebody I love is going to be taken care of, right? But on the other hand, you know, I'll still have plenty to worry about because the world is this open place where things are highly unpredictable. And so if we live too much in the little mind, we're going to be unhappy and anxious all the time. Because even very small things can bother us tremendously. You know, even very small things. Like the leak in my bathroom. You know, if I let it, that can bother me all day long. You know, and it's almost dreamlike. You know, the plumber came out, he looked around, he tapped on the walls, he threw a bucket of water on the floor. The water, by the way, came pouring into the foyer, you know. And he just said, you know, this is very complicated. You have to open up the wall. I just don't, you know, unless you want to do that, I don't want to get involved. Goodbye. So I could worry about that. You know, I could really But my feeling is, you know, I like, one of the reasons I like to do meditation is that when I sit down on the cushion, I enter this other mind, this other form of awareness, which is very, very, I think, expansive, connective, trusting, open. And I feel like $1,000,000, you know, when I do zazen. I will sit down on the cushion and I'm worried, I'm fretful about something. And you keep coming back to the moment, and this coming back to the moment is very, very healing. And I think it's you begin to feel very centered, very grounded, very trusting, and also very, I think, very open, like openness. You know, when you're in that trusting state, you know, when you're in the sort of distrustful mind or the doubting mind, you know, it gets more and more paralyzing. You become more and more afraid of consequence. The more you try to think down along these chains of possibility, the more frightening life becomes, right? But you know, that's sometimes we have to think along those chains, you know. But basically, that's not a satisfactory way to live, because it just produces endless anxiety, you know. And you can become paralyzed by seeing, you know, the long-term possibility of something down the road. That can be so paralyzing, right? Sometimes we just have to live and not worry so much, right? You just have to realize, I'm going to make mistakes, as if mistakes really existed. I'm going to do things that don't turn out the way I planned. It's inevitably the case. That's the story of human life. It's the story of life on Earth, you know. Things are not going to turn out the way I planned, but I'm not going to let that basically ruin my life, you know. I'm not going to give in to the fear of being alive. I think that's how I'm not going to give in to the fear of being alive. Right? Instead, what I want to do is enjoy the experience of being alive, which is the experience of openness, uncertainty, and so on. So people, you know, how do we embrace this life, which is crazy, unpredictable, and can be terrifying, right? And I find zazen very helpful, because I sit down on the cushion and I begin to enter this other state, which is, you know, serenely present, grounded in the moment, and eventually feeling this deep sense of trust, you know, trust. And then, you know, I feel like I can handle it. You know, I feel like I can handle it. I even feel happy, you know, happy. And you get off the cushion, and you have a different approach to things, you know. It's, you know, part of it is really giving up control. You know, giving up, a lot of Zen is about giving up on the project of control, you know. As you know, if you've done a lot of zazen, you can't control it. You can't. You sit down on the cushion and you think, I'm going to have this kind of a sit, and then you usually have a terrible sit. You know, usually you just say, okay, I'm here, I'm not sure why I'm here, but I'm going to do zazen. You do zazen, and sometimes you just wind up in the most wonderful place. And I think it has to do with just making yourself an instrument of the process, or allowing yourself to just be present with the moment as it unfolds, without any expectations. And that is surely the best way to live. You know, and when we do this, we feel better, we're happier, you know, we feel more trusting and open and alive, right? Alive. When you overanalyze, you paralyze yourself, right? You make it very difficult to respond creatively, usually because we castigate ourselves, you know. So it's possible, You know, it's possible to say, I know a friend of mine whom I love dearly, right? And he is now in his 70s. He's been married 3 times and he's had 4 serious relationships. So he has kids at every, he has a 50-some-year-old daughter who's just a few years younger than I am. Okay. Then he has a set of children at the next level, like, you know, 40s, right? In their early 40s. Then he has some kids who are just getting out of college, right? So he's had, like, you know, multiple layers of children. And he's had 4 relationships. And, you know, basically, I was talking to him on the phone. I love this guy. I love him. But he's crazy, just in the way humans are crazy. He said, you know, I think I finally found the love of my life. This is like number 5 or something. Really? Finally? You know? At one time, in a mood of, you know, he was, you know, I think what happens to him is he gets in these relationships and he thinks, you know, I probably have made a mistake. I could probably have found a better partner. I'm serious. I think he does this. Then he starts looking around. It's like, I think I've made a mistake. I boxed myself in. I need a different partner, you know. And at one time he told me his second wife, whom was the one I knew, he said, you know, I guess I could have lived with her. We didn't have to get divorced. You know, after all, I realized we could have done it. We could have stayed together. You know. But anyway, I just think he has like a mental illness, you know, basically. It's always better. The other possibility, the one he didn't take, is the one he wants. You know. And I think he actually feels regret, you know, all the time. I think, oh my God, if only I'd married her. You know, if only I'd done this. If only I'd done that. And this is another form of that same mental illness that we all have, you know, the worrying mind. So it's unlikely that we're all going to find a way to live without that mind. You know, there's probably very few people in the world who really are like truly, they never worry. You know, I think that's an unrealistic goal. You know, as I said during Sesshin, we all have like our own karmic obstacles. And to imagine that you'll be free from karmic obstacles is probably an unrealistic expectation. But the question is, are you going to let it ruin your life or not? That's the question. See, so we all have our own problems, but, you know, are we going to allow them to ruin our lives, or are we going to be creative? You know, so it's like having an illness you never quite recover, but you're not going to let it stop you from hiking in the mountains. You're not going to let it stop you from, you know, you're not going to give way to fear. Even though you're afraid, you're not going to give way to fear. You're going to recognize your fear and go forward, you know, go forward and take risks and try new things, even though you're anxious about it, right? And that's a realistic expectation, I think. And so, you know, it's unlikely we're all going to go, okay, thanks to Zazen, I sleep well every night, I never worry. That would be unrealistic. But I do think Zazen can give us, like, a tremendous sense of freedom. You know, sometimes I get off the cushion and I just feel like I'm floating down the river of life, you know? I'm not BSing you. It's a great feeling. It doesn't happen all the time. But every once in a while, I just feel like things are unfolding in this way that I can't control, and I'm just going with the flow. And I actually love that feeling, you know. It's a wonderful way to live. I can't be there all the time, but when I'm there, I'm very happy. And I don't think it's delusional. I think it's really a wonderful way to handle life, you know. I've told this story before, but there was a great Zen teacher in the 20th century. Her name was Jiyu Kennett. And she was from England, and she was like a very brilliant young woman who wanted to become a minister in the Anglican Church. And she was told, you can't be a minister in the Anglican Church because you're a woman, and there are no women ministers. And she challenged this. She said, show me why I can't, where does it say that I can't be ordained as a minister? And she, you know, she was very brilliant. She studied all the texts and she argued with people. And they finally said, okay, you can go to the seminary. She went to the seminary. She was like the top student. Okay, we'll ordain you. They ordained her. And she was an Anglican priest, but she wasn't happy. She was not satisfied with her inner life, and she went to Japan. And she found a Roshi, a Zen master, who agreed to accept this American woman, I mean this British woman, and she stayed and trained at as the sole woman in this temple in Japan. And all the monks were very troubled by her presence. First of all, you should know that Japanese have many wonderful characteristics, but like most humans, like most men, they're and especially Americans one generation ago, the Japanese are hugely sexist. They're just like amazingly sexist, and they were even worse at this time. Younger Japanese have changed, you know. But when Kennett went to Japan, they were hugely sexist, and they resented hugely a woman for imagining she could be a Zen monk. You know, it was just like, this is an outrage. You know, and they also disliked very much the fact that she was a white person. You know, she was a Caucasian, and so she was at this temple, and nobody wanted her to succeed. Everybody was hoping that she would find that, you know, freezing cold too tough. You know, the life too demanding, the discipline too overwhelming, and they would try to mess things up for her. So, you know, basically, if they all had to get up at 3:30 in the morning, one of the monks would say to her, "Oh, I'll wake you up. Don't worry," and then they wouldn't wake her up. So she'd race into the zendo late, you know, and be humiliated. Or, you know, if they were raking gravel, the monk would say, "Rake it this way," and then the boss would come by and look and say, "That's not how we rake it, you know, you idiot," you know, and people were playing these tricks on her that were very hurtful and isolating her. And finally she went to see the teacher, and she said, "You know, I don't think I can take it anymore. Everybody seems to be against me, and I'm having a terrible time here. I keep making everywhere I turn I make a mistake." And the teacher said, listen to me. He said, "Everything that happens is helping you to wake up. Everything that happens is helping you to wake up." See, and this was like a magic talisman, right? It was like, it transformed everything for her. You know, she just got up with a trusting mind. So, you know, she just kept saying, "Everything is helping me to wake up. Everything is helping me to wake up." And of course, this was like, she approached every moment in this spirit. And of course, the results were that her life blossomed. You know, eventually, all of these monks came to think, "Well, you can't beat her. You can't keep her down. Look at her spirit," you know. And they actually admired her after a while, and they stopped trying to give her a hard time. And, you know, eventually, she finished her Zen training. She received her transmission. She went back to California, and she got to California, and the doctors said, "You have a disease. You're going to be dead in 6 months." This actually happened, right? And she said, "You know, that's what you think, right?" You know, 25 years later, she died, right? And she created Shasta Abbey, which is one of the most successful Zen communities, Buddhist communities in California. You know, so this is a lot to recommend. This trusting mind. You know, there's the worrying mind. You know, but there's this trusting mind, and when we Zen is all about entering this other consciousness, which is connected, grounded, trusting, open. And, you know, the more time we spend there, the better. You know, it's like reminding ourselves that the worrying mind is not the only mind. You know, it's not the best way to live. And sometimes we can get off the cushion, and as we're going through our daily lives, we can hold on to that openness and that groundedness a little bit. And when that happens, life becomes like this It's like this natural unfolding. You know, the truth is, we can't control it. We can't. So, you know, if you are able to sort of like surf the waves of change, if you're able to go through these processes of change without holding on too tightly, if you can ride the waves, you know, you're going to be happier. You know, sometimes we get into this groove where it's all just unfolding. It's just unfolding. I can't control it. I'm just going to go with it. This is highly recommended, you know. And it's a wonderful way to live. This is called being one with the Tao. Being one with the Tao. You know, the unified mind in accord with the way. That doesn't mean the stock market isn't going to crash again. It means I'm not going to worry about it. I can't control it. I'm not going to blame myself. See? And it's a really wonderful way to live. See. Fayon asked Elder Zhao, "Did you come by boat or land?" See, this is like the dilemma. You know, well, if I say I came by boat, I probably made a mistake. I should have come by land. If I say I came by land, you know, no matter what answer I give, I'm going to give the wrong answer. See, so I can worry. Should I have come by land? Should I have come by boat? Why did I come by land? What's wrong with me? I should have taken the boat, you know. But if I go by boat, you know, doesn't that say something about my character? I should have gone by land heroically, you know. And you can go on and on. You know, basically, whether you go by boat, if you choose A, you're damned. And if you choose B, you're damned. See? Damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. So what are you going to do about it? You can be miserable, or you can say, both, no matter what I choose, I'm in the groove, see? It's just a fact, you know? You could have married Jane, and you married Sally, you know? Could have, you know, but if only I'd, now I see, marriage with Sally is hard. If only I'd married Jane, I'm sure she's a wonderful person. We wouldn't have any arguments, right? You know, wrong. If only I hadn't bought this house and I'd lived in an apartment, you know, all my problems would be gone. Whether you choose this or this, you're in the soup, you know, you're in the boiling water, right? It's just, that happens. So basically, one way to live with that situation is to say, if only I'd taken the other road. But the other road is also a difficult road, you know. There isn't one that isn't challenging, right? So. You know, basically, it's not the choices you make. You have to choose, but either way, you have problems, right? So it's how you greet these events, how you deal with change, you know, how you deal with your problems. Imagining a world without problems or a choice that wouldn't have produced obstacles is a self-torturing fantasy. So. This other way is harmonizing yourself with the unfolding of things. Nothing could be different from the way it has unfolded. Not one thing. Not one thing in your life could have been different. Everything unfolded just as it has to. And everything is helping you wake up. That's the teaching. So if we live a little bit more in that spirit, if we do our zazen, we get off the cushion and we say, everything is helping me wake up. This is a better way to live. And indeed, if we live that way, everything is helping us to wake up. Water doesn't wash water, because everything is already clean. Gold isn't changed for gold, because everything is already gold. Find a horse without knowing its color. Don't worry. Enjoy the lute without the strings, tying knots, drawing trigrams. When there are such things, when we're thrashing around in bed, worrying about this and that, completely lost is the true, pure mind of the original person. That's the mind we find in Zazen. And when we spend some time there, life is a great deal better.